Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Joel Slater, who's serving as our worship associate, our music director, Hal Walker, and a special summertime version of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent choir, with which we light our chalice this morning, come from the poet Walt Whitman from his volume Leaves of Grass. I hear and behold God in every object, yet understand God not in the least. Nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24 and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name. And I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever.
We are here as we are mortal, concerned, life-affirming, turned toward joy, facing our woes. To worship, to behold the mysteries of life and death without shield of creed or comfortable credulity. May our celebration in words, silence, sign, and song help move us into the company of the great cloud of witnesses who lives to unveil ever deeper truth, who yielded the wine of faithfulness when history's hard press was upon them, who hones their lives no less fragile or strong than our own on the whetstone of your demands and ecstasies. O love, life of our own lives, we begin again, intent on the good. Come, let us worship together.
Many of us have had Sikh communities across the country in our hearts and minds in recent days. Most Sikh gurdwaras are hosting vigils this afternoon, including the one south of Cleveland. Beginning at 12:30, they've invited anybody in the community to attend the last half hour of their service and then stay for the community meal, which always follows their services. So if you're free, you might consider attending. But even if you're not, I thought that we would like to take a moment this morning to be in solidarity with Sikhs across the country. And so our wisdom words come from Sikhism. Sikhs regard Guru Gobind Singh as the 10th and final living guru. After he died, the function of the guru as teacher and authority for the faith and conduct was vested in the community and in the scriptures, the Guru Granth Sahib. Sikhism was established over 500 years ago in the Punjab district of what is now India, and the first guru, Guru Nanak, was a person who was very mindful of the ways in which religion could be used to divide people from one from another. Among the core tenets of the faith as he revealed them are that people should be ever mindful and devoted to God, honest and honorable in their living, and strive for equality among humankind. Sikhism was very influenced by both Hinduism and Islam. And one of the scriptures in the Guru Granth Sahib speaks of the need for peace between the religions. These are his words. Some call themselves Hindus, others call themselves Muslims. Among these are Shias, there are Sunnis also. And yet man is one race in the world. All men have the same form. All are from the same source of light. I invite you to meditate upon these words as we keep a few moments of silence together. O source of peace, lead us to peace. Lead us to peace in our own beings. So many of us are divided against ourselves, harsh, critical, demanding, judgmental. Let us lay those criticisms down and see ourselves as we truly are, precious, each and every one. O source of peace, lead us to peace. Help us establish peace in our relationships. For too often, especially with those whom we hold most dear, the judgments and the criticism extends to them too. Our words, our facial expressions, the gestures of our bodies sometimes indicate that we are not at peace. Help us soften, open to compassion, and strive to be peaceful in all our relationships. O source of peace, lead us to peace in our communities, among the religions, between the nations. Help us do our part for the establishment of peace here on this land that we share. Amen, and blessed be.
William Ellery Channing was a Unitarian minister in the early 1800s. His influence in defining the theology for the new Unitarian denomination was deep and wide. This is an adapted excerpt from his sermon, Spiritual Freedom, delivered on Election Day in 1830. I call that mind free, which masters the senses, which protects itself against animal appetites, and which recognizes its own reality and greatness, which passes life not in asking, what shall it eat or drink, but in hungering, thirsting, and seeking after righteousness.
I call that mind free which jealously guards its intellectual rights and powers, which does not content itself with a passive or hereditary faith, which opens itself to light whensoever it may come, which receives new truth as an angel from heaven.
I call that mind free which is not passively framed by outward circumstances, which is not swept away by the torrent of events and is not the creature of accidental impulse, but which discovers everywhere the radiant signatures of the infinite spirit and in them finds help to its own spiritual enlargement.
I call that mind free which resists the bondage of habit, which does not mechanically copy the past nor live on its old virtues, but which listens for new and higher monitions of conscience and rejoices to pour itself forth in fresh and higher exertions.
I call that mind free which sets no bounds to its love, which wherever they are seen delights in virtue and sympathizes with suffering, which recognizes in all human beings the image of God and the rights of God's children, and offers itself up a willing sacrifice to the cause of humankind.
What are the sources of religious authority? Who or what do you trust to formulate your religious beliefs? These questions are at the center of countless controversies in the history of religion. This morning, we'll look at two that profoundly shaped the tradition we've inherited, one following on the heels of the other. They are recounted in the books of history as the Unitarian controversy and the Transcendentalist controversy. William Ellery Channing was one of the central figures and leading spokespeople in the Unitarian controversy. In 1803, when he was just 22 years old, he was called and ordained by the Federal Street Church in Boston. At that time, the ministers in the Boston area were generally considered one of two kinds, either liberal or orthodox. Channing was not inclined by temperament to take sides. He wanted Christianity to be broad enough to accommodate theological difference, but this conflict demanded that people proclaim where they stood. One of the pivotal moments came in 1805 when a liberal minister was appointed to one of the most coveted professorships in theology at Harvard, which was where most of the ministers in Massachusetts at that time took their training. The controversy erupted when the Orthodox ministers protested the appointment of the liberal minister. They felt that Harvard was being taken over by the liberals. they decided that they, in protest, would start a new school nearby in Andover, specifically for the education of Orthodox ministers. The debate in the public sphere was intense on both sides, each critiquing and in turn defending. The Orthodox charged the liberals with countless heresies and even accused them of being Unitarians, a name that was intended in no favorable light. In 1815, Channing decided it was time to clarify just exactly where the liberals stood. The occasion was the ordination of a young liberal minister, and Channing was selected to deliver the sermon. He called it Unitarian Christianity, embracing that ill-intended name as indeed reflective of their theological stance. Many of the heresies with which they had been charged were indeed true, he said. They believed in the Bible as God's revelation to humankind. However, they also believed that God intended humankind to use their faculty of reason in interpreting Scripture. From their rational and reasoned study of the Bible, the Unitarians Christians concluded that there is one and only one God. They believed in God's moral perfection, that God's justice was in perfect harmony with God's mercy. They affirmed Jesus as sent by God, but not God, for the spiritual deliverance of humanity. And they proclaimed, in opposition to their Orthodox counterparts, that humankind was not depraved and predestined, but rather created in the image of the divine with capacity for moral choice and the capacity to pursue spiritual progress. The sermon, it said, couldn't be heard by anybody past the front couple of rows, but the people in the front couple of rows took copious notes, and it was instantaneously sensational and rushed into print, and it became, over time, one of the most read sermons in the history of the United States. Though they, the Orthodox, were not in agreement with Channing, they felt that this sermon had to be distributed so people could see exactly the infidelity that they were facing. The liberals affirmed Channing's major theological claims, though they weren't all in agreement on the finer points. They decided to set that aside and focus on the major claims with which they were in agreement. Though all of the liberals understood themselves to be Christians, but the Orthodox had serious doubts about that. They thought that by their heresies, the Unitarians had indeed put themselves outside of the scope of the Christian communion. For the Unitarians, though, their identity was clear. They were Christians who had simply expressed Christianity in a new light. I said that there were two questions about authority at the heart of this controversy. The first one is about sources. The Unitarian Christians affirmed the Bible as their source of authority. They believe that the Scriptures, and most especially the New Testament, to be the account of firsthand witnesses. They trusted those accounts as the evidence of the nature of God, the mission of Jesus, and the calling of humankind. However, they also believed that the truth in the Bible was not simply evident, but rather required reasoned study to discern. Biblical scholarship, knowledge of the tradition, and sound judgment were all required in order for any interpretation to be considered trustworthy. And as Channing himself proclaimed, those who would be truly free must not simply accept truth because popular opinion had deemed it so. Those who would exercise the faculty of the free mind must search out truth for themselves and ever remain open to the possibility of new light, whensoever it may come.
Ralph Waldo Emerson began his career as a Unitarian minister, but later left his church to become an essayist, lecturer, and philosopher. He was a leading figure in the Transcendentalist movement that rocked the Unitarian church. This passage is an adapted excerpt from his essay, The Oversoul. Let us learn the revelation of all nature and thought, that the highest dwells within us, that the sources of nature are in our own minds. As there is no screen or ceiling between our heads and the infinite heavens, so there is no bar or wall in the soul where we, the effect, cease and God, the cause, begins. I am constrained every moment to acknowledge a higher origin for events than the will I call mine. There is deep power in which we exist and whose beatitude is accessible to us. Every moment when the individual feels invaded by it is memorable. It comes to the lowly and simple. It comes as insight. It comes as serenity and grandeur. Within us is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. When it breaks through our intellect, it is genius. When it breathes through our will, it is virtue. When it flows through our affections, it is love.
Ralph Waldo Emerson was called to serve as the minister at Second Church in Boston in 1829. By then, the Unitarians had succeeded in forming themselves into a slightly more organized denomination with the development of the American Unitarian Association. I say slightly more organized because they didn't want it to, they really intentionally did not want it to be too powerful of an entity. They were afraid that any institution would place excessive bars on the freedom of the individual to discern their own truth. So the American Unitarian Association was a membership organization for individuals, not for congregations. Emerson and the congregation he served identified as Unitarian, but Emerson felt confined even in the broad theological space that the Unitarians had carved out. After just 3 years serving his congregation, he resigned his pulpit. The reason he gave publicly was that he felt he could no longer, in good conscience, serve communion. Though some have suggested that the real reason was Emerson's sense that he indeed had a different calling to ministry than to congregational ministry. He embarked upon a career as an essayist and a lecturer, though for many years he continued attending the annual meetings of the American Unitarian Association and also continued to use the title Reverend. In 1836, Emerson began meeting with a group of mostly Unitarians, mostly young Unitarians and a few young Unitarian ministers who wanted to explore some of the new religious ideas coming from Europe. They called themselves a variety of names, but the name that eventually stuck was the Transcendentalist Club because of their interest in transcendentalism. Now, this is where it can get a little confusing. To transcend means to go above or beyond. When something is transcendent, it's beyond ordinary experience. In theological terms, when people speak of God as transcendent, they're speaking of God as out there, over, above, separate from humanity. But what the folks in the Transcendentalist Club had in common was their sense that the divine is indeed present in the world, in the soul, and in nature. Theologically, the word for that concept is immanence. Transcendence, out there, God is out there. Immanence, God is in here. So really, the right name for them would have been the immanentalists. But that's not what they were called. Emerson was widely seen as the leader of this club, which became a movement. In sermons and in essays, he called people to open themselves to an original experience of divinity. The foregoing generations beheld God and nature face to face, he wrote. We through their eyes. Why should we not also have an original experience of divinity? Emerson and his contemporaries were less interested in debates over doctrine or even in reasoned reflection on the miracles reported in the Bible than they were in experiencing miracles themselves. The poet Walt Whitman was deeply inspired by Emerson's writings. He testifies to this longing for the experience of miracles in his poem. Why, who makes much of a miracle? As to me, I know of nothing else but miracles. Whether I walk the streets of Manhattan or dart my sight over the roofs, houses, to the sky, or wade with naked feet along the beach at the edge of the water, or stand under trees in the woods, or talk by day with anyone I love, or sleep by night with anyone I love, or sit at table at dinner with the rest, or look at strangers opposite me riding in the car, or watch honeybees busy around the hive of a summer forenoon, or animals feeding in the fields, or birds, or the wonderfulness of insects in the air, or the wonderfulness of the sundown, or of the stars shining so quiet and bright, or of the exquisite, delicate, thin curve of the new moon in spring. These, with the rest, one and all, are to me miracles. Transcendentalists lauded mystical experience of union with the divine. They called that source by many names: God, universal being, spirit, the infinite, the eternal one. Emerson also called it that unity, that oversoul within which every man's particular being is contained and made one with all the other, that common heart of which all sincere conversation is the worship, to which all right action is submission. Emerson argued that direct, unmediated experience with that source was the primary pathway to trustworthy religious truth. He believed that the soul had the capacity to recognize truth. Real truth would come as direct revelation, accompanied by intense feelings that would not lie. He described his own experience in nature as sublime. In the woods, he wrote, we return to reason and faith. Though I feel that nothing can befall me in life, no disgrace, no calamity which nature cannot repair. Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part or particle of God. That comes from his essay, Nature, which was one of the first essays distributed by the Transcendentalists and widely circulated. That image of Emerson as a transcendent eyeball was captured and illustrated in periodicals and magazines of the time, sometimes in celebration of that mystical union and sometimes in caricature of these infidels who were branching even further out from true Christianity. The proclamations of Emerson and his contemporaries rocked the young Unitarian denomination. The Orthodox ministers pointed to the writings of the Transcendentalists to prove that the Unitarians were indeed well outside the fold of Christianity. Many of the established Unitarian ministers were eager to distance themselves from the heresies of the Transcendentalists. They largely agreed that the beliefs of the Transcendentalists were outside the scope of even liberal Christianity, and they urged them to resign, especially the ministers. But many of the Transcendentalist ministers refused to leave, and the Unitarians ultimately were not willing to kick them out. Besides, many people were eager to hear the Transcendentalist ministers preach. And so the Unitarians and the Transcendentalists lived in a kind of loose, very uneasy union, while Transcendentalism quietly transformed the young denomination.
Emerson found nature to be the source of goodness and morality and wisdom. He paradoxically found himself complete and whole when experiencing his self being dissolved in the majesty of nature. While at times I have felt this oneness with nature, particularly when in the vast spaces of the Rocky Mountains, I usually find myself fearful or unhappy about the nature of nature. There are the so-called natural evils of nature, the thousands of diseases that kill the young, the genetic mutations that rob human potential, the earthquakes and the volcanoes that have taken so much life. I stood in front of Pompeii looking at the volcano that killed thousands of people, some of them visible beneath ash coatings, with a feeling of awe and terror. I am also one whose attitude towards human nature is a mixture of optimism and pessimism. I know that love and altruism are a significant part of human nature, but also believe that much of human evil reflects nature as well. I tend to be in the minority of the opinion that nature is more divisive of the human spirit than is nurture. Contrary to the optimistic spirit that proclaims hatred must be taught, I think hatred comes rather naturally, and it is love that must be taught and reinforced. Many people believe that it is nature that has poisoned the relationships between men and women, while I think it is only nurture that supports equality. I think to some degree the transcendental attitudes toward nature are in part a reflection of the distance civilization put between them and nature. The Native Americans on this continent all had stories about the dangers that lurked in the forests. And so I feel a certain shallowness in my soul as a result of the feelings nature causes to arise there. I would like to feel more at home here, but for me, salvation, if it lies anywhere, does not lie here on earth. There is too much unredeemable tragedy here, too much unrecoverable loss. The lines in the spiritual, I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world of woe, but there is no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I do not know if there is a brighter world to which I go, but my Unitarian Universalist faith sustains me to work for less sickness, less toil, and less danger in the world in which I am.
So what are the sources of religious authority? Who or what do you trust to inform your religious beliefs? The early Unitarians rested their faith on the authority of the Bible, interpreted with their faculties of reason. The faith of the Transcendentalists rested on their own direct experience of the divine as evidenced by the feelings stirred in their own souls. Contemporary Unitarian Universalism names six primary sources from which our living tradition draws. Four of them, the guidance of reason, Jewish and Christian teachings, direct experience of transcending mystery and wonder, and the rhythms of nature, directly reflect the theology of those earliest Unitarians. The other two sources, wisdoms from the world's religions and the words and deeds of prophetic men and women, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love, can also be traced back in our history. This is our inheritance. Ours has been, from its earliest days, and remains a pluralistic faith. Channing argued that we must be open to new truth from wherever it comes. He himself was not eager to embrace the Transcendentalists into the Unitarian fold, but there was that claim. We must be open to new truth from wherever it may come. And so the Unitarians weren't ultimately willing to kick the Transcendentalists out. And then later, the Unitarians and the Universalists weren't willing to kick the humanists out. And in the last 20 to 30 years, the tent has widened again to affirm the place of pagans at our table. Individually, we represent many points along the theological spectrum. Our recent congregational survey revealed that among this congregation, there are people who describe themselves as theists and atheists, humanists and panentheists, mystics and pagans, and the list doesn't stop there. We're bound together not because we all have exactly the same beliefs, but rather because we've made the same promises. We've promised to do our very best to live caring lives of love and service, to seek after truth, and to do our part to help bend the moral arc of the universe toward justice. This isn't easy, even on good days. So we come together week after week to remind ourselves of our promises and to find support and inspiration for our journeys. It can feel like an intimate, vulnerable thing to speak out loud what you believe. And so I want to thank Joel for sharing with us some of his own thoughts about nature and salvation this morning. His viewpoint in dialogue with Emerson represents yet another point on the theological spectrum of Unitarian Universalism. Drawing on the insights of science and the observations of religious and natural history, Joel has staked his claim. Your beliefs may differ from his, or from mine, or from those of the person sitting next to you today, and that's okay. We've long affirmed the wisdom of the sage, we need not think alike to love alike. Engaging respectfully with another person who differs from us gives us a chance to practice connecting across difference. That's a critical skill we all need for life in this world today. Ours is a wildly diverse country, and we need to know how to connect with people who keep practices we would never choose and who believe things we cannot abide. This community is a wonderful place to practice. I believe that prayer makes a meaningful difference. You may believe otherwise. In respectful dialogue, we can each say how we've come to believe what we believe, and, just as important, what difference our beliefs make in the quality of our lives. That's part of what goes on in our chalice and food for thought groups. Incidentally, we'll be starting new sessions of each later this fall, and if you haven't yet participated, I commend them to you. Both of our small group ministry programs offer opportunities for forming deeper connections than casual conversation usually allows. And that, after all, is a big part of what we're doing here. We're looking for deeper connections with ourselves, with others, with a community, with a tradition, or with that great mystery in which we live and move and have our being. We'd each describe it differently, but we're all looking for some kind of connection. Our lives are so fragmented. Everyone is so busy, rushed, rushing. Here we gather to slow down, to rest, to breathe, and to remember that our birthright is wholeness. Not fragmentation, but wholeness. And so we sing, we reflect, we sit in silence, some of us pray. Each of those are spiritual practices designed to remind us that we were born holy and whole. Each of those spiritual practices designed to call us back to the eternal truth that life is a gift. Life is a gift. Life is a gift which we're called to savor and to serve. May it be so, and amen. We gather this morning, one Unitarian Universalist congregation. Thousands others are gathering right now in this country and all across the world. This is a proud tradition, one that has the power to deepen, transform, and even save lives. We who dwell in this place are the inheritors of this particular Unitarian Universalist community. The gifts that you give today help support and sustain this community so that it will be here for generations to come. If you're our guest this morning, we have a gift for you as a token of our welcome. There's a candle in the basket. The offering will now be gratefully received. So I asked Hal if he was going to say a few words about his new song. And he said yes, but since he didn't, I'm going to say a few words. He went to the Musicians Network Conference, the Unitarian Musicians Network Conference a few weeks ago, and he came back so inspired. I knew because he sent me about a dozen text messages while he was there. This is so great! So he came back and wrote a new song that we sang a couple weeks ago, and then he called me on Monday and said, I'm really excited about Sunday's service, and I'm here with Margo, and we're writing a new song. Do you have any input? So I wasn't there to get the message, but they wrote this beautiful song just on Monday, and this wonderful choir learned it. It's really hot off the presses, so thank you all for learning it and singing it today. I send you with these words from Lauren Ballamy. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If here you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If here you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace.